We're beginning the Catechism. The first part of the Catechism focuses on the Apostles' Creed, and that's the topic for this whole series. And it begins with what it means to believe. So, we know some things. I'm going to sound as though I know what I'm talking about, by the way, because I want to be clear. But of course it's big stuff I'm talking about, and there'll be philosophers who'd have different opinions on it, and you will too, maybe. I'll give it my best shot. You know something when you make a judgment based on evidence. That's knowledge. You believe something when you make a judgment based on trust. Trust of this scientist, trust of this economist, trust of this politician, trust of this pope, trust of this wife. You get me? So they're the key distinctions. Evidence, trust. As a little baby, a first beginning baby, day one, we know nothing. Our waking hours consist in a stream of sensations. Don't ask me how I know this. Smelling, tasting, seeing, hearing, touching, putting in your mouth. You know all about this better than I do. And feelings. I'm a little bundle of feelings. I want food, sleep, touch, and I pick up the moods of my mother, particularly. Dad too, but mum's so intimate there. And that's what happens when I'm a baby. To know, we need a question, an inquiry. An inquiry that concludes with a satisfactory answer. And we begin to know quite young. I'm just reminding you of your own childhood. At first, someone else asks the question, and provided it requires no double checking, we're able to investigate as a little child and achieve an answer. No, mummy, the car's not in the driveway. Darling, check whether the car's in the driveway because I don't know where Bill is. No, it's not in the driveway, mum. And you trust the child, and the child knows because it checks. Yes, mummy, the baby's awake, but she's not crying. Oh, good. Mum is rightly confident in the answer, and so is the child. The child knows that the car's not there and that the baby is not crying. Knowledge is starting. Then, as every parent knows, we start asking our own questions. A little personal thing, if I may give it away. I was a pain. Mum, tell me. Everything was why, how? And she could give me, none of her answers satisfied this little brain. So she had to send me down to watch the chooks. That was her way of getting rid of me. Because she told me every time a chook bends down and has a drink, it always thanks God. So I went down, and it's true. No chook ever did that without thanking God. And I was pretty impressed. And I watched them for hours. So, it's just all true. Our parents learnt the art of providing part answers to our questions. And they satisfied the little 3, 4, 5-year-old. We weren't old enough to know that their response didn't really provide a satisfactory answer to the question. It left further questions to be explored. But we didn't know this at the time. However, in simple, uncomplicated ways, you and I grew in knowledge. At the same time, most of the responses we gave as a small child, we learnt from our parents and from others that we trusted. We said to people what Dad said or what Mum said, didn't we? Or what teacher said. We weren't really knowing, we were believing. We were saying something as true based on trust, not on evidence. We accepted something as true because we trusted. We didn't check it for ourselves. We weren't able to. Still, as adults, this is important, this reliance on belief covers most of the things we think we know. Lonergan gives its percentage at 90-something percent. Nearly everything you will tell me you know, you don't know, you believe, actually. I don't mean believe in God for a minute, you just believe it. I believe that the earth goes round the sun. I do. If there's anyone in here who doesn't believe that, I think you're in the wrong room. I'd be foolish not to believe it, since everything I've come to know points in that direction. At the same time, I haven't taken the trouble, you may have, to carry out for myself the complicated physics and math needed to establish the fact that the earth is actually going round the sun. I wouldn't quite know where to start, I have to tell you. There's so much to know. Even if we were capable, we'd be foolish to reject all the belief and accept only what we know because we've established the truth from our own resources. That would be such a foolish way to live. The whole scientific endeavour would collapse if scientists refused to accept as true, that is, believe, what other scientists have established. There's always a hesitation there. There's always a maybe, but you build on what other people have done and then get the breakthrough. A huge percentage of the answers that we give are based on belief in those people we trust. And you've just got to ask yourself how many things you've really checked for yourself right to the concrete at the bottom and know from right up. And there can't be too much like that. In his book on method in theology, Bernard Lonergan, who's he died in 1984, I think, and he's a brilliant philosopher. For me personally, he gave me my mind. I never met him, but I read his book Insight in the seminary when I was 18, and I couldn't get it. It was just too hard. Then I went back and read it when I was university chaplain, and I got it, if I could say that. And I've read all of Lonergan since. In fact, I read it all again to prepare for these lectures. And when I say I read all Lonergan again, I'm talking about that much stuff, you know, like thousands of pages. Because he's a very good mind. Well, see if you like this. Something he said in his other book, Method in Theology. He said, check it for yourself. Human knowledge is not some individual possession, but rather a common fund from which each may draw by believing and to which each may contribute in the measure that he performs his cognitional operations properly and reports the results accurately. That's all obvious to you in your own field. A person doesn't learn without the use of his own senses, his own mind, his own heart, yet not exclusively by these. He learns from others, not solely by repeating the operations they've performed, but for the most part by taking their word for the results. Through communication and belief, there are generated common sense, common knowledge, common science, common values, a common climate of opinion. No doubt this public fund may suffer from blind spots, oversights, errors, and bias, but it's what we've got, and the remedy for its shortcomings is not the rejection of belief and a return to primitivism, but the critical and selfless stance that in this, as in other matters, promotes progress and offsets decline. That's on the web. You can find it later. It is dense, but I think it's quite a brilliant statement, and I actually think it's really quite obvious, but that might only be because I've read Lonergan often. But I think you get the point, I hope. So that's how we live. And that's why, for distraction away, that's why a culture such as my parents built up and my grandparents built up and that I grew up in as a young boy, I'm forever grateful for it. Wonderful, wonderful people, many people worked hard to get unions going and a few rights for the workers, tried to get a bit of justice for those who were not at the top of their pile by birth, you know what I mean? There was a lot of stuff went on, and I'm wondering whether our culture is declining because of the lack of proper public discourse and debate at a time when every opinion's equal. You can have your opinion, I can have my opinion, I've got to give you your right, I've got to respect you, and therefore I respect your thoughts. Don't respect my thoughts if you want me to cook you a meal. Show me. Or check. And I'll say, oh no, I put that in there, but if you put that in there, it's poisonous. Oh, is it? Oh, gee, I better not do that. Like, we're not all equally good at everything, so we need everybody to, well, he said it better than I am, I'm just talking now, contribute your search. And when you've gone to bedrock in some area, which you would have, and I have too in some areas, then let's share that with people because it's solid and it's thought through and it's known and it's real. But most of it we're jumbling around on the surface. Strictly speaking, this is critically important. Test it, check it for yourself. You've got to go into your own mind and watch your own processes to do it, and you might have to do it again later, going onto the web to find the stuff. To claim to know something, four things have to be in place, says Bernard Lonergan, and you can't jump them, and the first one must come first, and the second one must come second, and the third one must come third, and the fourth one must come fourth, and there's no mucking around. Let's start. You have to be attentive to experience, point one. In other words, you've got to look, you've got to listen, you've got to smell, taste, touch. You've got to be there with your alert to what's actually going on. Not only alert to the objects that you're watching, and some of us find that easier than others. I'm pretty hopeless at it, to be quite honest, because my brain is whistling up there and here's something in front of me and I haven't noticed it. But some of you are more, you know, get all the details and might never thought in your head, of course, but you've got to... No, we're all different. So you have to be alert, not only to the objects out there, but you have to be alert to the inner responses that you're making to it. So it's an internal thing too. Some people can be very clear on everything out there, but not at all clear about their own heart or their own feelings or their own responses or who they really are. Both are needed to get to be attentive. Second, being attentive is first. Second is being intelligent, using the word in the strictest sense, intus legere, reading within, asking questions about what's happening, not just stating it all, but why, how, when, wherefore, you know, all these questions that naturally come up, but you've got to pursue them. What's actually going on here? Now, we're not encouraged in that with our culture, because our culture is about a two-second grab. From politicians or anybody else. They've got to be very smart to say what they want to say in the time they're going to be given by the media, because we don't want to sit around. You're so good. But most people won't want to sit around for 5 minutes trying to follow an argument. But you're going to get 2 hours today, so cheer up. We have to look for insights that might help us discover answers to the questions that we ask about what we're experiencing. What is this? What's going on? Why did she say that? You heard what she said, but why did she say it? You notice something happening, but that's strange, because that normally doesn't happen. I wonder what's going on. You've got a computer. Oh, what a day I had yesterday, but let me not tell you about that. And it's not the you want to print it, and everything's connected, so and the printer won't work. So you think, God, so you check your connections and check that it's on and still won't work. Then you go somewhere else because you've got a problem and you've got to explore it. And finally you find out that the printer is actually on hold, but you can't see that on your thing here. Somehow or other you've clicked hold and it's just waiting there. And then you think, and when you click that and it starts to print, there's a nice sense of relief, isn't it?
Yeah.
That it's actually working. because you've engaged your intelligence and you haven't given up and you've persevered with trying to find out what's going on. Third, you get an insight. You think, ah, that's what it is. Is it? You have to go back and check your insights. This is what they say, being reasonable. Check it. You might think that because your father thought it and your uncle thought it and everyone else thought it. They thought that the blacks in South Africa weren't equal to the whites. Or, let's talk about Australia. Do you know what I mean? We've got our kind of prejudices that are there. Or we're whatever. We've got to check it. Check it from reliable sources. We've got to go back to the sources and say, is that really true that all these people who are coming out here are just economic migrants? Then you go to the thing and you look up, then you look up Hansard, you look up everyone else, and the facts are that 90-something percent of them aren't economic migrants. They're actually here for real reasons. But does that stop the media saying it, or the politicians saying it, or some shock jock saying it and getting away with it, and people keep listening? Beggars belief, but there we are. We've got to learn to check our insights till we're satisfied that we looked at everything from every relevant angle and our questions have been satisfactorily answered. They're three processes. And by the way, the more you do them, the more you do this, the more you'll do that, the more you'll be attentive. They double back and help each other. And finally, we come to where knowledge lies. Knowledge doesn't lie in insights or thoughts. Knowledge lies in the judgment. You're right when you say it's not raining or it is raining. You're not right when you say what rain is. I mean, we're talking about a judgment here. So we have to form a judgment based on the evidence about how things really are, as distinct from how I think they are. And you don't defend your own opinion. Oh, this has happened to me all my life, so I'm sure it's happened to you. The point of to defend my opinion because it's mine has to be so stupid. Don't do it. I hope I don't do it. But if you see me doing it, just come up and say, come on, mate, get real. You defend an opinion because it's true, not because I think it's true or because it's mine. That's the process of knowledge, each one building on the other. And the four imperatives that are there are really better than the Ten Commandments. Seriously better. If you spent your moral life being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, though I haven't got the word there, checking, and responsible, making able to respond to reality and do something about it. If you spent your life with those four, if I spent my life with those four, I'd be a very good person, because I wouldn't do anything wrong. You wouldn't be, because you'd be following all that. And we can all do that. Doesn't need an academic career for it. Every step along the way, this is good to know, it's wonderful. Every step along the way to being attentive, being intelligent, being reasonable, and then responding with judgment that's accurate, every step along the way we experience, you have to check it for yourself, don't believe me, but when you think about it, you'll see it's right. We experience a spontaneous, dynamic drive, moving us to experience things, people, situations, and to want to understand what it is that we're experiencing. Kids are doing it all the time. Two-year-olds are doing it all the time. Not only I was doing it, but every two-year-old does, to different levels. When an idea occurs to us that might lead to understanding, we experience a spontaneous, dynamic drive to check it, to make sure. Like, that's natural. We can become, we'll talk about that in a minute. At times, we have to look elsewhere for an answer. At other times, we think we're onto something, but more questions arise, and we have to follow these up till we run out of relevant questions. And when all our questions have been satisfactorily met, we experience a spontaneous, dynamic drive to conclude our inquiry. The reason why that all that thumping was going on my roof last night was because we've got possums. It wasn't a robber, though it sounded like it, but it's actually we've got possums. Well, that brought a little relief to this little palpitating heart, wondering what I'd do to these thundering bloody crooks on the roof. On the evidence, we conclude that our understanding is true or false. Sometimes we're certain. Nearly all the time, we've got a level of probability. We say, yeah, well, this looks, it's just in the science area. This seems to be the best way to go, and this seems to be pretty right. And then you experiment, and it'll have to be tweaked and tweaked, all that kind of thing. Now, it's essential that we reflect carefully on these various steps. You can't do it here, I suppose, but maybe you are trying in here. When we do reflect, we find this was the first insight I think I got when I did philosophy in the seminary at the age of 18. Because we were troubled by a lot of the philosophers. Hume was one of them, you know, go back a couple of hundred years. And their point was, you can't know anything, because I know you, but I'm knowing you with my mind. Like, and then I reflect back on me, but I'm reflecting back with the same mind that did the knowing in the first place. So that actually nothing's real. The phenomena is unreal. It's all kind of projections from my internal... I won't go into all that stuff with you because it'd drive you barmy. But the beaut insight that hit me, and I still remember I was walking down the avenue and I got it. It's nice when you get it, isn't it? Like that bloke who leapt naked out of the bath and worked out that the Archimedes, was it? The gold. Eureka. Yeah, Eureka. And the Eureka moment was to realise that, wait a minute, in the act of knowledge, it's not as if I know you as an object. Then in a second act, I reflect back on my knowing you, so I become the object then of the reflection, and it spins around and spins around, eventually you can't go anywhere. The beauty of knowledge is that in the actual knowing you, there are two poles to knowledge, and both of them are immediately present and in consciousness. One is, I know you, and I know myself knowing you in the very one act of observation. Maybe to you it's been obvious all your life, but I can remember when it hit me when I was 17, I thought, that's got to be it. And of course, that's what the philosophers who are worthwhile tell you. So, when we do reflect, we find there are two poles to each step of our inquiry. It's because of this that we're confident that we're knowing what really is, not just what seems to me to be. We know that intelligence, this searching mind that we've got, this inquiring mind, is in touch with reality, not projecting something from some noumenal spot. In the very same act, we're aware of the object we're experiencing and we're conscious of ourselves as the subject having the experience. Sometimes we ourselves become the object in a second act, of course. In that case, in the same act, we're conscious of ourselves as the subject and object of the awareness. In the very same act, we're aware of the idea we're examining, and we're conscious of ourselves as the subject doing the inquiry. It's all present to consciousness in one act. And in the very same act, we're aware of the conclusion we've come to, the judgment we've made, and we're conscious of ourselves as the subject forming the judgment. So, to summarise that as best I can, they're the five imperatives that Bernard Lonergan would suggest for your and my behaviour. They're stunningly wonderful, and I think that he's proved it, and it's it. There they are. Be attentive to reality and your response to it. That's not easy for some of us, but do it. Learn to do it. Be more of it. Teach your children to do it. Educate to do it. I do a heck of a lot of work with teachers, and not recently, but for years, all over the bloomin' New Zealand and everywhere, I used to do this Lonergan stuff. Because it's the key to education, is to get... If children learn to do these things, the world's their oyster. Secondly, be intelligent. Don't just jump to the next station. Don't jump to the next argument. Don't jump to the next exciting thing. Penetrate till you get to what it's really about. Thirdly, be reasonable. Check your insights. There's so little of that in the public arena. You'd think, maybe there's a lot more, but you don't get the impression there is. And the newspapers that come out, I'm not blaming them particularly, but they blurt out something, and if it happens to be wrong, if you notice on page 3, there's a little thing that you can hardly read that tells you that they made a mistake. Like, it doesn't, it's not... And then fourthly, be responsible. Respond to the way you know things to be, because we're involved in this. We're not sitting back in an academic thing getting all this knowledge. I could do a PhD on love and never hold hands. Well, I don't think I know too much about it, but I might have got my PhD with a high distinction. And then I saw a woman and I went, oh, shit. And then went. I mean, that nearly happened. No. So, you know, being responsible is really... We're involved in this. There's something I've got to do about this. There's something I can contribute to this thing that I've now discovered about asylum seekers or the injustice about Timor or whatever. And finally, I'll come to this, I won't stay on it, the key to it all is to believe, which is actually nearly our topic. Because you see, if I believe, if I don't believe in you, any of you, one of you, if I don't believe in you, if I don't believe my teacher, believe in my teacher, am I going to be attentive? Am I going to be asking these questions? None of it will work. This is the key. That's why believing in God, which is where we're heading, is so vital. As long as we ditch all the false gods, and then we end up with something stunningly beautiful, marvellous, mysterious, sacred, and undescribable. But it's absolute. Once we get that, if we get that, then everything becomes alive. And we can dare, because you're not going to be attentive if you've got the wrong idea of God, for example. Who's going to be attentive to their behaviour if God is this... You don't think about it. Or go to confession and confess it and go and do it again straight away, which I doubt if anyone does today, because not too many people come to confession. But that's why we might have behaved in past times. Now, here's some of the difficulties with all this. Are you going all right?
What's it been up till now? What's it been up till now?
Right.
Not difficult.
Well, it's not easy to work our way thoroughly and honestly through the steps that I've given you. We can be inattentive to what we experience. Husband, wife, often. He starts a sentence, she finishes it. I'm not blaming men, or I'm just saying, but... He actually was going to say something different today. But she knows him. She's been living with him. Oh, for God's sake, 50 years you've been talking, blah, 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 blah. And she hasn't listened because he was actually wanting to say something a little bit different today. So he reads the Globe, if it still exists, and looks at the races and gives up on it. Or he to her, you know, not listening, knows. How attentive are you? It's a good question. We can be uninterested, insensitive, content to live in a world dominated by our feelings. We can muddle along from one experience to the next without making the effort to understand what's going on. And we do that as teenagers maybe, we might have done it as little children. God, we do it when we're 80 years old or 76. When on earth are we going to grow up? We don't want to make the effort to understand what's going on, to integrate our experiences into our life in a meaningful way. We can opt out of concentration, discipline and perseverance needed to pursue truth. Instead, we can choose to dissipate our energy by living a distracted life, a dissipated life. Maybe drink, drugs, sex, could be whatever else to fill our thing. Or just vegging out in front of TV because we're really tired. So we bore ourselves in a wall and get our brain sluggish. I presume it's all right to do it sometimes, like on Wednesday night when it's the state of origin. But apart from that, we can lapse into a stupor. So that's why we say what someone's stupid. They're a stupor. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh. We can substitute what we pick up from talkback radio for the effort to check things out. Find it just, well, anyhow, we're all different. How there? our people keep listening to stuff when it's clearly garbage, just stuns me. But anyhow, we do. Some people do. Now, this is still an examination of conscience for you to think about, and it's all on the web to go back to in depth. We can misunderstand. We can mistake, just to break the word up. We can make no effort to check our assumptions. We can wallow in our prejudices. We can lock ourselves into an ideology, conform to habit or trendy opinion. By not questioning the first thought that comes into our mind, we can work from oversights, illusions, rationalizations. We can be silly, gullible, and careless. This is the best homily I've given for a long time. This is getting much more like the blood and thunder stuff that we should have dealt out. By the way, I'm talking to myself out loud, so don't feel crook. We can jump to conclusions. We can prejudice a situation or a person. We can fail to connect with what's real, and so we can fail to arrive at the truth. Again and again, we come to know that our spontaneous and dynamic drive to know does connect us with what's real. This is going to be a key to what I want to say later. When we allow ourselves to reach beyond our comfort zone and pursue the truth, whatever the cost. I know one person, he's died since, my brother Jim. And he was just amazing to me in many ways. But the thing that amazed me, well, not most, because I was very fond of him and he had so many good qualities, but the thing that amazed me most about him was we could be debating some issue of church life, God knows what, and I would say something that he hadn't thought about. He'd say, oh, right in the middle of the debate, oh, yeah, that changes things. Flip, changes opinion, like that. Which means he was looking for the truth, not looking to win an argument. Do you get it? That's pretty good. I'm not sure I'd manage it. I'll give it a go, but he did it. And I watched him do it, and I thought, and I'd like to be like that. I'm sure you would too. There is a spontaneous dynamic drive to know. It does connect us with what's real, and we allow ourselves to reach beyond our pursue the truth, whatever the cost. It matters. In matters of significance, our grasp of truth is rarely complete. It's a progressive extension and refinement of our grasp of reality by a progressive extension and refinement of the self-transcendence. That's the key, which is what love is. Getting beyond me. That moves us from a world of experiencing to a world of knowing. There are special difficulties today in making this move. Karl Rahner, whom I also studied at great length with these things, has this to say in one of his investigations theologically. He says, this is the problem for us, the enormous amount of knowledge offered today leads to uncertainty. The speed at which science are racing into the future makes every individual element of knowledge already acquired appear to be temporary and subject to revision. Nothing is solid, it would appear, because it's too much piling in on us all the time. Knowing is not something arbitrary. It's not like tossing a coin. Knowing meaning making a judgment based on evidence. To the extent that our search for the truth is authentic, we can be confident that our intelligence is connecting us with what is. Today we need a special courage to assert what we've come to know as true. Each of us has come to know, based on evidence, different things, and we have to be courageous to name it and not to say, oh, darling, it's all right, you think differently, but I think differently, and then we don't argue. And then we get like, we become like the public arena from which debate has gone. Real debate, largely. I think that's not overstated. Go back to the time of John Henry Newman, middle 1800s. And in the newspapers, there was public debate. People took sides. They said what they thought. Others disagreed with them and said what they thought. We tend to duck, I think, and don't say it and don't present it and kind of want to keep comfortable and not worry and not get in the way or not be picked on or not, I don't know what. And if I've got this all wrong, you'll know. It's important, however, not to limit knowing to the process we're familiar with from the empirical, this is good, empirical sciences. That's a wonderful way to know. Thank God for science. Love can deceive, but it can also open up areas of knowledge that take us beyond our senses and rational logic. I know more through being loved and loving than I could ever learn in any university, and so do you. Love, that is, the self-giving to another who accepts the gift and returns the gift of self. You all know, you've learned so much through that. So have I. So let's not stay with a scientific model, though basic, it's basically there to encourage us all. But love has to be the key. It's the fruit of being an authentic subject. Belief, that's knowledge. Belief. We can say that we believe when we accept something as true because we trust. We can choose to trust and believe, or we can choose to not trust and not believe. There are many layers of belief. Excuse me. There's the belief that a child has in tooth fairies. When I was chaplain, when I was a parish priest of Kipax, this dear little thing, I got a call from the school, and there was a dear little darling little thing. She's even sweeter now, she's a bit older, but little thing. And she lost her tooth. And I happened to be down there doing something at the school, and the teacher came and told me. So, you don't know what to do as a priest, you don't learn all these things. So I got a little bit of paper, and I wrote on the paper, Dear God, dear tooth fairy, I've forgotten her name, Monica has lost her tooth, but as parish priest of Kipax, I assure you that she did have the tooth, and and please look after her. She took it home, got the penny or whatever your mum's gifted to the fair, came to Mass the next Sunday, and thought I was just it. I think probably remembers it to this day, but. What am I telling you that for? Oh yeah, belief in tooth fairies. Or in Santa Claus. I believed in Santa Claus till I was about 10. I finally found out, I won't tell you the story because it'd take too long and I've got too much to do. But system, whatever. And then I went home and Mum told me finally. She said, oh, thank God he's starting to think. So she told me all about it. I ran outside with no malintention to tell my little sister, who's 18 months younger than me, because I got such a shock. And I went out and said, do you know there's no... There's no oh, she said, I've known for years. Oh. So girls can be pretty, you know. But still, it was a little bit deceptive because we used to get an extra present at Christmas from Santa Claus. We used to get the family, you know, little tiny things, socks, but then we'd get a little surprise, she and me. And I got mine innocently, I have to tell you. She plotted. But women aren't always like that, are you? I mean, you
well, I never told my little brother just in case Santa Claus decided not to come to me.
Well, there we are. Well, thank God, you're married well.
We're sure.
So as children, thank you, we're not in a position to ask questions. We trust our parents, so we believe. As adults, there are many things that we believe because we trust experts in the field. We find that our belief is supported by the constant reinforcement that results from acting on this belief. It's already noted, without belief, the scientific community would grind to a halt. Conscious belief always is a result of choice. Living would be impossible if we doubted the accuracy of every measuring line and every street directory, even though we hadn't worked it all out for ourselves. At the same time, we don't follow our beliefs blindly. We're dealing with probabilities. And while this ruler or this directory could be wrong, it's highly unlikely, and we simply don't have the time or the knowledge to check everything for ourselves. When our trust has proved right over and over again, it's reasonable to continue to choose to believe. I'm sure you'd agree with that. At the deepest level of our conscious experience, belief that is based on tested trust and knowledge that comes from love overlap. Knowledge that comes from love and belief on trust, so that we can conclude that to believe is to know in trust. It's another kind of knowledge when it's been tested, etc. Once again, there are many layers to this. In some matters we have grounds for certainty, in other matters we accept something as probably true, in yet other matters we accept something as a working hypothesis until further evidence refines our judgment. So, nearly to conclude this section, when is it reasonable to believe? Now, this is what I think. You could provide your own better answers, but this is what I'll offer you. It's not always sensible to believe. I've just been sucked in by a scam, I won't go into it now, where I had a little bit of money set aside for the publishing. I lost it all, and after 52 years of priesthood, I thought I was reasonable at picking up phony from real. But if someone comes presenting with a really deep need, I'm not going to close the door immediately, you're going to try. So, but I only found out recently the whole thing was a scam. So it wasn't sensible for me to believe her. At least I made a mistake in believing. And the person whom we believe should be worthy of trust. It's naive and often foolish to believe someone who's untrustworthy. Even if a person is generally trustworthy, this is a key point, I hope, it's reasonable to accept their word as true only in the areas where they're knowledgeable. Professor somebody, who's a professor of marine biology, makes a statement about God from a concept of God that he picked up in primary school. Well, does his being a professor make any difference? No, it just means he's got there without much brains, I'd say. Which you can do. You know, as you know, if you persevere, any of us, if we persevere, got nothing better to do, and you persevere in a university forever, you can probably end up with a pretty high degree, having wasted 10 years of your life to get it. I don't know. But it doesn't necessarily mean intelligence. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon for experts to claim authority in areas beyond their expertise. I no doubt fall into that myself. Try not to, but be very surprised if I don't. There are problems, too, with hearing things second and third hand. We'd be wise to believe only when we're confident that our believing does in fact come from the knowledgeable and trustworthy expert who's claimed to have said it. From our side, there are two important criteria for reasonable believing that I could suggest to you. One, what I believe must be consistent with what I know in other areas. People seem, I'm not excluding myself from this, but us human beings seem to be quite capable of having a block here and believing one thing and knowing something else, and the two are inconsistent, but we never face it. We just go along with it. So what I believe must be consistent with what I know. If you're asked to believe something and science and logic and everything you know says it couldn't be true, scrap your belief, for God's sake, because it's junk. It may go beyond science, of course, and it may go beyond logic, just as love goes beyond science and logic. It may go beyond them. But if it's actually contradicted on that level, you're foolish to believe it. We can tentatively hold hypotheses that appear contradictory while we search for higher viewpoints. Is light a... What are the two things? A wave, or is light a
photon?
And no scientist knows the answer to that. It presents different ways at different times, so you've got to kind of hold both in your hands as you kind of pursue the mystery. Sadly, it's not uncommon for us to compartmentalise our knowledge and not examine the connections between things. We're capable of holding as true matters that are in fact contradictory. Another criterion is the fruit, this is a beautiful one, the fruit of in our lives of believing. We cannot know everything through independent personal investigation. To live, we need to accept many things as true on the word of another who knows. If, through believing, I find myself becoming, here we go, more attentive, more thoughtful, more reflective, more truthful, more responsible, more loving, well, my believing would seem to be reasonable. If things go the other way, if you believe something and it's making you more narrow, less attentive, more bigoted, more bitter, more bloody whatever, chuck your belief, will you? Because it's not helping you and it's not helping anybody else. Since to believe is to accept something as true based on reasonable trust, there is value in reflecting on the role played by love in relation to trust and so belief. The word believe goes back to the Anglo-Saxon roots of the English language. The word L-I-E-V-E is an older spelling of love. To believe is actually to be in love. I believe in God means I love God. I'm in love, and God is the mystery within which I am. When we begin the creed with the words I believe, we're speaking of what we've come to hold as true because of our experience of love. Everything is going to lighten up now, but you're going to stay another 5 minutes till I finish this first half. I've tried to do what I do, well, I won't go over it. It's the best I can do with it. It's all up on the web if you want to work it through for yourself. In the Catechism, we read this to get started on the Catechism. Faith is our response to God who reveals himself and gives himself to us. Himself, it's pretty hard to do. You could keep writing God's self, because himself is actually hopeless. Or herself or himself. There's no gender in God, of course. So, but in practice, our language has been so old and long, we keep using the male pronoun for the general, inclusive one. And if I were writing that again, I'd probably put God's self. But it does get a bit awkward in English. Okay. At the same time, bringing us a superabundant light as we search for the ultimate meaning of life. To believe in God is to commit yourself to the search for the ultimate meaning of existence. You don't have to go on that search. But if you don't go on that search, I think your life is actually very superficial, and one day we'll all wake up to see how we've wasted it. Chapter 1 of the Catechism, the topic of this lecture, begins with a quote from the Vatican Council. And here it is. Human dignity rests upon all, above all, on the fact that we're called to communion with God. What an extraordinary thing. As a human being, the main thing we all need is to be in communion with God, whatever we mean by God for a minute, but God, the mystery that's at the heart of everything. This invitation to converse with God is addressed to us as soon as we come into being. If we exist, it's because God creates us through love. And through love continues to hold us in existence. We cannot live fully according to truth unless we freely acknowledge and love and entrust ourselves to the Creator, says the Vatican Council. The Catechism goes on to speak of the ambiguities and paradoxes that we see in the human religious response to God. And it's important that we acknowledge these ambiguities and these paradoxes. They make us respectful of religious cultures and languages that are different from our own, without in any way lessening our gratitude for what we've been shown as disciples of Jesus. It helps to keep open the limits of our own viewpoint and to be open to learn from the many rich insights that are part of our heritage as human beings. So we're really keen to listen to the Dalai Lama, of course. And we're really keen to listen to Mahatma Gandhi. And we're really keen to listen to any saint that's in touch, aren't we? We might begin by asking ourselves, what are people talking about when they say, I believe in God. Because many Buddhists say God is nothing. But be careful. What they're saying is God is no thing. Well, God isn't a thing. God isn't another object. God isn't there's you and you and you and there's this and there's that and there's another object for inquiry, namely God. If that's our idea of God, we've got it totally wrong. You can't have God plus anything. Otherwise, God's finite, and that by definition falls apart. So God has to be something much more subtle and present and sacred and mysterious and everywhere for us. Okay, so as far back as our records go, people who experienced the sea have been moved with profound reverence for what they've experienced and have found ways of worshipping the God of the sea. The name given to the sea god varies from language to language and is of no real significance. The experience too varies. Sometimes the aspect of power dominates. Sometimes it's the amazing variety of moods that have captured people's imagination. Sometimes fear seems to play a huge role, and sometimes faith is put in magical rituals and rites that are believed to win the favour and avert the anger of the powerful sea god. You know the story of Jonah? Well, all those pagans worshipped Yahweh because they wanted the boat to be okay. Peoples channel their experience into hundreds of different understandings and practices. But I suspect that there's one fundamental experience that lies at the basis of all these different responses. Am I right? I don't know, but I think it is. It's a sense of communion that people experience. Just check yourself. There are some parts of this world where when you go there, it could be for you the sea, it could be the night sky, it could be a quiet little alcove where there's trees, it could be anywhere where you feel in some, I don't know how to put it, except that you feel belonging. You feel in communion with God. In ways that are too profound to understand, there's a connection between us and the sea. Somehow we belong to each other, and its moods and my moods interact. When we experience the various moods of the sea, we experience the various moods of our own heart. Tragically, human frailty, including hunger for security and power, can obscure this primal experience of communion, and the religions of the world witness to dreadful human behaviour done in the name of worshipping the sea god. Agamemnon slaughters his Iphigenia's daughter to the gods of the winds so that the winds will take the ships to Troy. They were, and so what does he do? He kills his daughter and thinks the angry god that's causing all the problems will think, oh, okay, and I'll change. It's very primitive. It's hopeless. It's ugly. It's dreadful. However, and we've got to look at our own religious practice and see how ugly and dreadful it can be too. If we can abstract from these, I suspect that believing in the sea god by whatever name is acknowledging a profound sense of wonder and awe, and even more importantly, this experience of belonging, of communion. Parallels can be drawn with people's experience of a grove of trees, a spring, a mountain, a storm, light, darkness, birth, death, a bird, animal life, the seasons, the many varied harvests, mother, father, sexual union, childbirth, dancing, music, painting, and the myriad human experiences that have given rise to worship all over the world in different ways. And it all should be deeply respected but critiqued by the inquiring mind. Since there's no obvious connection between the sea and the grove of trees, throughout human history, the norm has been what we call polytheism. There are many gods. That was the norm. People have their favourite god, but they've sensed in various ways a communion with the mysterious, awe-inspiring gods, the divine presences in all their experiences. Some people, and consequently some cultures, drew close to what we call monotheism, which is an extraordinary insight, if you get it. Just stunning. The amazing insight, that the mysterious divine presence with whom they experience a profound communion is the one God, the one presence, present and revealed in the different ways, in the various experiences, that the God of the sea is the God of the grove of trees, is the God of the stars, the heavenly sky, is the God of the earth, that everything belongs to everything. It's very Catholic, it's very all-embracing, and in fact, the concept of God that doesn't go as broad as that has to be dropped. Ancient Judaism is sometimes spoken of as a monotheistic religion. And there are indications in the ancient texts of a gradual movement towards this. However, the Bible, the writings of the Old Testament scripture, give no evidence of the kind of profound respect for other peoples that is surely essential to genuine monotheism. In other words, they would have ticked the box and said there's only one God, but the one God is our God, not yours. So suddenly monotheism is on its head. You've lost it. If one genuinely believes that it is the one God who's at the heart of and expressed and revealed through everything, this is big, 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 big stuff. One would not disrespect others just because they're different. We'd still have to deal with error, our own and other people's, but surely monotheism includes the insight that everything is fundamentally an expression of the one source and so is fundamentally sacred. Francis of Assisi got it. I think the Dalai Lama seems to have got it. Mahatma Gandhi seemed to have got it, I'm not sure, because I don't know enough about their lives. So it's three. Jesus got it. Paul got it, and maybe some of the other apostles did. Not sure, quite sure. Could we get it? Could we really get it? Look at the religious wars after the time of the Reformation period. There wasn't a monotheist on either side of the war. There were, but they were silent or incapable. The failings of classic Judaism can be seen in the behaviour of others who claim to be monotheistic, including the followers of Jesus of Nazareth or Muhammad. At the same time, history is full of genuine monotheists who've recognised that the communion that they experience at the heart of their varied experiences is with the one sacred presence, who is at the heart of and at the same time transcends everything. Years ago, when I was 20, I think I read Teilhard de Chardin, which I was very keen on in those days, because he's a poet and he's also a scientist, and he gave the best description of God I've ever heard. It's never been improved since. God is the heart and the beyond of everything. God is the heart of everything. The heart, like the sea. But when you get to the heart, closer you get to the heart, the closer you go into mystery, closer you go into the beyond. You can't contain God anywhere, in any church or person or place. No, this is a presence that's constantly self-giving and creating and love-giving and forgiving. An outstanding example of this is Jesus of Nazareth, who refused to live within the limited thinking and practice of the religion of his contemporaries. Who is my neighbour? When did we have that? Yesterday?
Yeah,
Sunday. Yeah. Who is my neighbour? And the bloke knew who his neighbour was. You can find it in the book of Sirach. Your neighbour is a man, a faithful Jew. That's it. That's your neighbour. Not a Samaritan and not a Moabite or an Ammonite or an Edomite. No, that's what your neighbour is. And he says to Jesus, well, who is my neighbour? And Jesus tells the story which you know too well. And it ends up saying your neighbour is any human being that you come across is your neighbour. A love that's all embracing. And those among Jesus' followers who have grown to share Jesus' experience have done the same. And to conclude, in the light of Jesus' example, perhaps we could answer the question posed here by saying that for a true monotheist To believe in God is to believe that everything belongs to everything. And modern science, by the way, supports all this. Thank God for Einstein. He dragged science into the whole religious sphere in a wonderful way. Not too many scientists seem to follow that on, but the great scientists know all this because they know the mystery of just about everything in the scientific world. To believe that it belongs to everything else. Everything that exists is held in existence by the one mystery, the one source. It's part of an explosion of love radiating from this source and revealing different aspects of the source. If we use the word grace for the action of this source, to believe in God is to believe that grace acts like gravity. It's grace that keeps the moon and the earth in this dance. It's grace that has an exploding universe coming out of love, a self-explosion of God's love. Drawing everything into beyond, into communion with the source who is immanent in creation but who transcends it, who, in the words of Teilhard de Chardin, has God is the heart and the beyond of everything.